be blue, 'cause I can't see you. Richie, I love you.
Hey, welcome to episode 54, Vince Daniels Archive Outsider Podcast. This is your host, Rich Wexler. I'm really excited that we have Ileana Douglas. If you don't know them, they've been in countless films, countless series. I'm not mentioning all those because I'm still trying to respect the strike and promotions of things, and it's not always been clear what's okay to say and what's not. All I can say is I'd seen they were posting about a book called Connecticut in the Movies, and I really felt like looking into it that it was great for us, so we got to talk. And again, they are such a, I mean, honestly, one of the top five film scholars in the country, if not more. But very, you know, very natural. I mean, you can tell that there's a fan in there. You can tell they got their knowledge from being a fan and by just following organic things, you know, that made sense to them. Watch this, watch that. But I don't really know anyone else who has seen that many films and can talk about them in such clarity, but also in certain ways, like a good teacher, where it makes sense, where it's very natural. It's very, you feel like you're talking to a tour guide versus an historian. And that's how the book reads. I highly recommend her book, Connecticut in the Movies. It's a very large size. It's an art book, really beautiful. I'll be honest, this is not anything about her work, but I'm generally not a huge fan of the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But however she did it, and again, this is her strength, is I fell in love with these movies that I never would have looked at. It's just this way she talks. It's just very organic and very much just about, you know, what you hear from a fan that is really educated. So I highly recommend getting a copy of it, of that book. It's really amazing. I read it from front to finish and loved it. And again, just a pleasure. She's, to me, a rock star. Has such an interesting history in terms of who she's known, who she's worked with, her acting, producing, all kinds of stuff. And again, it was an honor and a privilege to speak with her. So please enjoy. This is probably one of my favorite episodes I've done in a while. And I'm really glad this is, you know, at the beginning of the second season. So enjoy. Thank you. It seems like there's 10 people that have the most knowledge of film, and you have to be in there somewhere, because your knowledge of film overall is very impressive to me. From, I remember I saw you in the documentary about the cult. It was a documentary where you were talking to, and I don't know, I'm just impressed with your knowledge of film, especially in this book, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to first ask you how's your house? Where's your house? I feel like you talked about the house in the beginning of the book, and then it drops off a little bit. I was curious what's going on with your house.
Well, you know, again, when I was writing the book, although I think that's a great introduction, it's, you know, it's not a book about, you know, me redoing the house, but it is a book that's about a journey of coming home. And that's why the book is bookended with the film that I did, which is called The Green, which is in the film, the character is coming home back to Guilford. And so, you know, I wanted to be very careful that, again, this is a book about Connecticut movies. It is a cinematic road trip. I'm driving, I'm telling the stories. It's a balance between what is about me and what is about the film.
I love that it's, you know, it's part of your narrative. It's, you know, you talk about your grandfather. I love that there's so much there. I mean, it reads like you're doing a tour. I can imagine you doing this tour in person, but then there's a lot of narrative. And I just feel like, I don't know, some of the stuff that people write could be very dry. You have just a way of kind of making all the, you kind of go in it, you go move around a lot, which is exciting to me. It's more of a conversation. And I love that you have your own life in there. There's part of me that after reading this is imagining some kind of like Connecticut film board that just approves films. And it's, the questions are like, is this a love story? Is it a dysfunctional family? Does somebody die? Is it based on a real story? There's so many interesting commonalities, which is to me like the really interesting thing in the book is that in a lot of ways, a lot of the movies that are made are kind of this, have a similar vibe or a similar story.
It's a similar plot line, but light and dark. And again, that was fascinating to me, was that the same plot, somebody from New York moves to the country for a better way of life and turns out it's a happy ending, is then turned around and there's a movie like Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which is basically the same plot, except this time, you know, you move to Connecticut and, you know, you meet vampires or the undead.
Yeah, I was very happy to see that section. That was probably the, I think the, I'm a big fan of the Ice Storm. It's one of my favorites. The section on dark suburbia, the redux of dark suburbia, but especially the weird section, and then just the one with horror was just, you know, I mean, and again, I feel like, I don't know, there's something very down to earth about how you wrote this and about you talking about it, which doesn't judge that film any different than another film, which is really nice.
No, I thought it was very important in terms of recognition. You know, for example, somebody like Del Tenney, who did these low budget horror movies, which people like, you know, Quentin Tarantino, you know, really applaud these grindhouse movies. So not only did he, you know, work with what he had, that he later used his money to start the Hartman Theater Company, and then did theater. He and his wife did theater and contributed greatly, I think, to the artistic landscape of Connecticut. So to me, it's, I always like to shine a light on people and films that, you know, we don't really necessarily know enough about. And he was a prime example of that.
I had a question. I'm curious. It seems like there's a parallel. A lot of the movies seem to plot is based on people going from the relation between New York and Connecticut. And I'm curious on the story, you know, the plots of the films tying to that, but I'm also curious on how much of that ties into like the film production end of it, where people are making similar choices to shoot in Connecticut versus New York. I'm wondering if there's any parallel between like setting choices to set movies there as well as choices to film movies there in terms of your research. I don't know if that's something that is answerable or not, but I'm just curious if the proximity to New York.
There's a lot of organic origins to these stories. So going back to the silent era, D.W. Griffith is doing short films and he's hopping on the train and he's going to Greenwich, which then was farmland, but it was also where, you know, wealthy, you know, men at the turn of the century were building their mansions right outside New York. And he was utilizing their mansions, you know, to shoot his movies. And so I thought, you know, it's just a story as old as time. There's filmmakers scrambling around and he had found a wealthy benefactor in Greenwich and he let him shoot his movies on his property. And so, and then after that, you come across this woman whose name was Alice Delamar, and she starts inviting, you know, she lives this bohemian lifestyle, and she starts inviting her artistic friends from New York, like come, she's a wealthy benefactor and has people come stay with her.
Okay.
And then after that, in the 1930s, and you have people from Broadway, obviously Katharine Hepburn grew up here, but other people like Frederick March, people start getting a country house in Connecticut because it was very much farmland. And then immediately right after that is when you see these 1930s movies that Hollywood starts making. So it does not seem accidental that the first films about Connecticut are idyllic and they are much more geared towards country bumpkins. It's as we get later and later and later that we get into dark suburbia. But the initial films like Theodora Goes Wild, like Gary Cooper's In Name, In Name Only and stuff, these early movies, they show a lot of farmland of Connecticut. And they're all movies about transformation.
I was also curious on you growing up, seeing these movies, like what were the theaters like? Like, I'm wondering, I don't know, for me, when I think about film, sometimes I think about a movie and I think it's the experience in a theater or a particular theater that why I love certain films. I'm just curious on you growing up in that area, like were there old school, were there, you know, fancy old film houses? Like what was it like as a film goer growing up there?
I was very lucky that I had, I mean, you know, now I look back on it and I realize how lucky I was, but we had the drive-in movie theater. So that was dusk till dawn, you know, second, third, fourth run films, sometimes five films on one bill, you know, for a dollar, be watching all the films as the drive-in progressed and we started nearing the 80s, it became strictly horror movies. But originally, you know, you'd be in the car, you'd be watching, you know, Report to the Commissioner would be third on the bill, or, you know, Dirty Harry, Crazy Mary, whatever the name of it. But it was, you know, on the same bill as American Graffiti. It was like there was no rhyme or reason to any of these movies. But so I saw a lot of movies there. But then we had in Middletown, I used to go to a theater. There was the Capitol and the Palace. And I don't remember his name, but the man who ran both of these theaters was an older Italian gentleman. And apparently, from what I've heard, he really programmed the movies quite seriously with an artistic bent.
Wow.
And so, again, I had my parents taking us to crazy movies like El Topo.
God. How old were you when you saw El Topo?
The kid, you know.
Oh,
like,
my God.
We didn't know any better. We just went.
I don't know if children should be exposed to Jodorowsky.
Why are we, you know, we wandering out? But, you know, people went to see the movies as a, you know, it was an artistic thing. We went to see the movies. I remember seeing Robert Altman's A Wedding, you know, 99 cents. So, and I knew, and it was only going to be playing for a week. So I saw it. I made my mother bring me every single night. You know, when I later met Carol Burnett, obviously, I love the Carol Burnett show, but we got into a 20-minute discussion about A Wedding. I said, I saw it five times. And she kept saying, why? And I said, I don't know. I was a kid. I loved movies. Obviously, my grandfather was a movie actor. He gave me something to talk to him about, to see all these films. So I was very lucky that my mom would take me to see these movies. You know, I liked Richard Pryor, right? I didn't know anything about Paul Schrader, but I like Richard Pryor. So, oh, okay, I'm going to see this movie, Blue Collar. You know, my mother took me to see it, you know? Like, I would see it as a grown-up. I'm like, oh, my God, what the hell? That's how we were when we were kids, and obviously we didn't have the internet. If you liked the actor, you went to see. If you liked Al Pacino, you went to see Cruising. You didn't know what the movie was about, you know, halfway through it, you're like, I don't think I should be seeing this. But then the final movie theater, which just obviously had a profound effect on me because they showed, it was a Revival House movie theater out of Trinity College called Cine Studio. And I wrote about them in my book. And again, it was very much part of my childhood. My parents would go there to see, you know, obviously all the foreign films, British films. They loved Alan Bates. So I'd go see Alan Bates movies, and Dirk Bogarde and Alan Rudolph. Yeah, Altman, any foreign movie. And even though I didn't really understand the movies sometimes, I just liked the experience of going to the film. And then I would sit in the back seat and I would listen to them, you know, discuss the movie. And that was a generational thing. In my day, except at the drive-in, even if you were on a date, you know, you'd go to a Friendly's afterwards and you would talk about the movie. I don't think, you know, now I guess we talk about it on the internet, but that was sort of part of the social aspect of the date, of whether they liked the movie or didn't like the movie, or, you know, that was our way of dating and socializing, you know. And a whole crowd would, afterwards of seeing a movie, everybody would be on their various dates at Friendly's, you know, talking about the movies, whether the guys liked it more, whether it was Raging Bull, whether the girls, you know, I liked it more if it was Urban Cowboy. And, you know, I don't know. That was just a very, movies were much more a fabric of, you know, dating and our social lives growing up.
Were you kind of wired to talk about films when you were young the way you do now in some way, or not so much?
You know, what's interesting is I didn't articulate it, except I would write down, you know, I would write movie reviews just for my own benefit. I don't know why. Sometimes I'd write satirical. If I saw something on television, some really bad movie, like, you know, The War Wagon, I'd write a satirical, you know, review of it. And I would send these things to my grandfather. And he gave me a lot of film books to read, and also a lot of Robert Benchley and Dorothy Parker. And so they were, you know, Robert Benchley was a theater critic. So I think all these things are sort of percolating in my head, you know, seeping into my own writing. I was never thinking, oh, one day I'll write seriously about movies. But as I got, you know, older, and I started working for Turner Classic Movies, you know, they asked me to do something for my grandfather. And that's when they kind of realized, oh, we didn't really know that, you know, you were really this kind of film historian in a way. And I hadn't thought of it either. I just liked to talk about movies, and I knew I'd seen a lot of movies. But then that's when I kind of figured out that my whole lick was going to be this sort of insider outsider approach, and that I was in the movies, but I like to talk about movies. And as you had said, from the perspective, not an intellectual perspective, I'm a movie fan. I'm a movie buff. That's how I like to write, like a storyteller.
And I think, you know, I don't know, like I'll be honest, like I have a bit of a block when it comes to like older black and white movies. And when I was reading about them, whatever you did made me excited about these movies in a way that I had never, ever thought about. There's some block I have where I'm like, oh, it's from the 30s and 40s. I can't get into it. But like, you made me really want to watch some of these movies that you mentioned because of just, I don't know. There's, you know, in academia, it's boring. It's this very down to earth. I love how you just kind of get into your, like, you'll go from talking about this to like something in your own life, or just, and then I think that's the best way you can do this stuff, because, you know, do we really all want to be just impressing each other all the time with our film knowledge? Like, it's not any fun.
Yes. Well, I like to watch movies, and, you know, again, maybe I pick up on something different that, you know, than other people have written about. I mean, for instance, and I guess I always don't like it when a movie is dismissed and then, oh, we never really talk about it again. And so, for instance, a movie like Jackknife, which, you know, Robert De Niro movie, and Stanley and Iris, and they're kind of overlooked films. And I wrote about Stanley and Iris from the perspective that there's, you know, there's some De Niro movies where obviously he's the bull, and he's, you know, and that's his form of acting. But I said, there's a certain series of films that he did, like Stanley and Iris, like Jackknife, like Awakenings, where his own inability to communicate is front and center in the film. And I like those movies too, because I'm, as an audience member, I'm at home and I'm almost articulating along with him. That's why I wanted to highlight those two films, to show that it's a variety in his canon of acting that sometimes gets overlooked because we love Goodfellas so much, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting because I don't know if it's just who you are as a person or what you chose, but there's a certain authenticity in you and in a lot of the work you're highlighting here, that it's, you know, I mean, almost all of these movies in a way, or a lot of these are based on real stories, real people. And so it brings it to like, there's a realness in a lot of the things you picked, in my opinion, that you can tell that it's authentic people doing authentic things at the, you know, at the best of their ability and within the Hollywood system. And again, you like also just talking about certain movies that are, you know, talking about like, I don't know, The Swimmer, in the same respect that you're talking about Let's Scare Jessica to Death, to me is just, that's it's all the authenticity. There's not a lot of judgment in this at all, and I feel like that's the strength of it. You're taking each thing and showing the value of it in a way that, you know, not everyone does.
Yeah, I think I'm the first person who's ever done a serious study of 60 sex comedies, and they're so prolific, and so many of them take place in Connecticut, and they're incredibly kind of tawdry, misogynistic. You know, everybody is drinking, correct? You know, they're in a way they're darker than the ice storm, you know, I thought it was important to write about them just to say, how did we get here? You know, how did we go from a movie like Christmas in Connecticut, where the main character is a single girl, writes for a very successful magazine, and by the end of the film, she gets the man she wants. She doesn't have to marry the guy she doesn't want to marry, and she gets to keep her job. Like, that's unbelievable. And, you know, that's the 1940s. You cut to, you know, Rally Round the Flag Boys, which is Joanne Woodward. And it's all about her losing her husband because she's not sexy enough. And all the men are off commuting, and he's tempted by, you know, his sexy neighbor, Joan Collins. And he has to be, you know, the wife has to be nervous at every turn that her husband is going to be stolen away from her. And the women no longer work. I mean, it's a fascinating sociological study of what really was happening in America. As women's roles diminished in real life, they diminished on screen. And it took a real long time for us to recover from that.
When I love the section around separate wives, and even talking about the politics around that and how even like women's groups protest, you know, it just kind of, you know, and you don't even think about that. And that's, yeah. I want to get back to that. I'm curious, with like in terms of the dark end of things, what were two or three of the films that early in the 30s and 40s that you would say led to the creeping into the more darker, that might have gotten you from the Christmas stuff to Stepford Wives? Like, was there any certain films that starting to push the boundaries that would have gone to more of the ice storm, the things that started to get a little dark, and kind of what that was like?
Right. The transition begins. It's almost, and again, I wrote the book almost like a movie. The middle of the book, we get to Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, which is how Hollywood sold Connecticut as not only a place to live, but the right place to live, you know, and with the right kind of people. And what was that message? Who are the right people? I think we know, you know, they're the right people. And yet it's a fun, happy movie. It's, you know, fantastic comedy. And and that's how the movie ends, with a happy ending. Everybody can have their dream house. And right after that movie, as we get into the 1950s, the first movie you see is Gentleman's Agreement, which is about covenants, restrictive covenants in Darien, Connecticut. So that's the counterpoint to Mr. Blandings. Mr. Blandings is about living in the right place in Connecticut, selling Connecticut as the right place to live with the right kind of people. And then once they're here, the cracks begin to appear. We start going, well, wait a minute. We've got these sophisticated New Yorkers coming from a diverse culture in New York City. Now they're in Connecticut and they're beginning to see, I didn't know about these restrictive covenants. You know, this is problematic. You know, do I say something? Do I not say something? And the character in Gentleman's Agreement, Gregory Peck is doing a story. He pretends his name is Phil Green. He assumes the name of Phil Greenberg to do the story, and he's engaged to a woman, Kathy, and she's from Darien, and her sister is in Darien, and she begs Phil to tell everyone that his name is really Phil Green. He's not Phil Greenberg. And it becomes a breaking point in their relationship. And what you find out, it's why it's such an incredible film, is even nice people like Kathy, who believe in his story, really don't want to, you know, rattle people up too much in Connecticut. So that's where you begin to see the cracks. And then the movie right after that, interestingly, which is also Gregory Peck, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, where it attacks upward mobility. So in Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, Cary Grant is a successful advertising, you know, guy working on an account. In Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, guess what? He's a war veteran who goes to work in advertising and hates it. Like, you know, feels like he's in prison, but his wife is really pushing him. She wants like a big house in Connecticut, the very thing that in the 40s they were pushing everyone to have. Now you have this veteran who he's experienced all this trauma in the war. He's had an affair with an Italian woman. He has a child. He's keeping all of this hidden from his wife. And she pushes him until basically, you know, again, the marriage sort of cracks open because he doesn't want to be, this kind of work isn't, he's not cut out for it. And so it attacks that, again, that wanting the, you know, the American dream. And the movie culminates with a just absolutely violent fight on their front lawn of this house. The whole movie, that's all she's done is say you're a coward, and you know, she wants this is her dream, is to have this house. And then by the end of it, when, you know, she pushes him to be honest and succeed, and when he finally admits to her, he hates his job. He hates, you know, he's had an affair with this woman. He's had a child out of wedlock. You know, her whole world now is been smashed, you know, to bits. And she runs outside and they end up having this violent fight, which is so jarring for a 1950s movie on their front lawn. And it only gets worse, progressively worse from there until we get, you know, the Swimmer, Stepford Wives, etc.
Swimmer, I never heard of Swimmer. I saw it maybe 10 years ago and I loved it. It's such one of those films you don't really, and I'm glad, it's so nice that that's the cover, because it's such an odd film in the context of at least Hollywood. And but just to kind of get into this stuff, it seems like I'm also wondering, with the times, you know, you talk a lot about race, you talk a lot about gender. It seems like there's the transition, like, you know, there's not any big movies you mentioned about like hippie era, but there is a lot of the same changing of roles, changing of culture from the 50s to through the 70s that are highly mentioned in the time you're covering. And it's such an interesting way to really kind of tell the history. I mean, to me, this is, you know, this is also equally a history book.
Yes, it has a lot of history. But briefly, when you mentioned hippies, Last House on the Left and Let's Scare Jessica to Death, I think both involve hippies.
I have not actually seen either one of those, unfortunately.
Yeah, it involves the wood in Last House on the Left. You know, they, nice family lives in the country, and the daughter wants to go to a concert, and they're like these rogue of, you know, hippie guys, and they end up and they attack her in the woods. So it's very much anti-hippie. Same thing of Let's Scare Jessica to Death also has a little bit of that. The people living in the house, are they vampires? Are they the undead? Or are they just dirty hippies? You know, we don't really know. So there's a little, but we were talking about history. That was, again, the balance. How do you write about a movie like Parrish, which people have sort of dismissed as a glossy melodrama, but to me is the only film that is completely about the tobacco industry in Connecticut, agriculture, which was a major, major part of Connecticut and the Connecticut state for many years. And people were, it was just, again, part of the wallpaper. People got summer jobs. They worked in the tobacco fields. It was a job that people took before you were 16, and that was an acceptable job, like to go work in a tobacco field. I never did it, but you know, I had friends who, it was something that people did. You know, maybe they lasted a day. It was incredibly important. But it's about the end of the film. For me, represents the last gasp of glamour of the studio system. It's Claudette Colbert's last film, but it also represents the end of glamour and money and wealth in Connecticut, you know, and that's what is also about these tobacco tycoons. It's kind of like dynasty in the tobacco fields. Again, like Bringing Up Baby, which is filled with kooky heiresses and rich people just, you know, getting drunk and having fun. Now you see rich people, troubled, generation gap, parents can't get along with their kids, all these cracks, you know. And so I try to introduce the history of Connecticut always to show how complex it is. It's not just one thing that has been portrayed in the movies. It's many, many things. That's always what has kind of fascinated me.
Yeah, I think what I meant before, and just to clarify that, I was using hippies, but it was more like that section, there's like 20 years there, that to me is the building of the counterculture, culture, but not from a story you would think, you know, it's not from the musical Hair, but it's still, you know, it's somebody who is, it's like, I don't know if you've ever seen I Love You, Alice B. Toklas.
Yes.
It's like, here's this, I mean, that is a little more hippie, but it's from a perspective of someone who you don't really think about becoming, going counterculture. And so it's an interesting approach, because I feel like you're having people question these basic structures of the 50s and 60s in a lot of these movies. And I think that's really the strength of the book, of just kind of, you know, I don't know, just that history. Like it's very in tune with what was really happening, and it's interesting to tell it from a perspective of like, well, they're rich, they have everything in the world, and the only I can explain it is I'm a big musical fan and I love Sondheim, and I feel like it's like Sondheim changed these happy-go-lucky stories to darker, and I think in the same way that it seems like these movies went the same way, where it was real stories, it was darker, more honest, you know, more reflective of the times and the changing times.
Yeah, there's a beautiful film. I mean, I must have watched it about three times because it's such a delicate film. And then it's sometimes it's hard to write about something that is so delicate. And you want, you know, what is the through line of the film? But the movie Rachel, Rachel, which stars Joanne Woodward, is, you know, it touches on, again, this a woman where the sexual revolution is kind of passed her by. And a guy who she knows from high school, she's home and she's taking care of her very demanding mother, and she's a school teacher. And as she says at the beginning of the movie, she, you know, she's a school teacher, and she says, "This is my last ascending summer." Now, you don't quite know what that means. It's like, does that mean she's in her 30s, or maybe, you know, maybe she's on the cusp of being an old maid? And a guy from her past comes, and you know, he just hits on her immediately in the bar, and she's so taken aback. And so it shows that she's here, she's sheltered here in Connecticut. She has no idea what's going on in New York. There's this whole sexual revolution, you know, going on. And she lives in this town where everybody knows her business and it's very repressed. And so it does get into, in a very serious thing, again, this is kind of what the movie Theodora Goes Wild is about. A woman it's a comedy in the 1930s where Irene Dunne is, you know, on Sundays plays the church organ, but secretly writes these sexy novels. And, you know, and then eventually the town finds out, and they're all aghast. Yet on the one hand, they're all reading the book and talking about it, but on the other hand, they're condemning it. So there's this Puritanism that Rachel talks about, and again, it's that, you know, the beginning of for her sexual revolution and breaking free from her parents and what it's like to live in a small town. And eventually the end of the movie is she leaves the town. There also is an amazing scene with Estelle Parsons, who reveals to her in a moment of just, you know, complete vulnerability. She's comforting her, and then the comfort turns into her kissing Joanne Woodward and her, and it's like, this is what, you just go, whoa, you know. And it's about these two women, you know, they're both, you never know, you know, and the idea that Estelle Parsons can't share with anybody that she is a gay woman. And you look at this, you know, movie that is from the 70s and see how far we've come. But that's, it's a very, you know, it's a very upsetting scene, you know, but it's also a beautiful scene because it's their friendship. It's a lot of things, but it's a very delicate film. But an important Connecticut film, obviously directed by Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward stars, and made in Connecticut, and an extremely important film to be re-looked at, I think.
I'm wondering, if I'm not mistaken, you have experience, you come from theater, correct?
I mean, I started out, you know, doing theater as a kid, yeah.
There's something in a lot of these movies that feel like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that feel like they're almost theatrical. Some of these movies with the melodrama feel like they're theater, in my opinion. I'm wondering if being in theater, seeing theater kind of, I don't know, influenced maybe some of the tastes in these things. Do you see, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like some of the movies, they play more out like recorded plays than films in some ways, in terms of the structure. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just getting that. This is a thought that kind of popped in. I was just wondering if these feel like, if it feels like something, you know, being involved with theater, having love for theater, if that particularly maybe got you more interested in some of these films, if you see any comparison or not.
I don't, except for, I mean, the only ones that were actual plays were the, which again, nobody is tied to my knowledge, Eugene O'Neill, one of our greatest playwrights, to the fact that he wrote two plays, Ah Wilderness and Long Day's Journey Into Night, and the same house and the same experience. And one is New London, Connecticut, you know, turn of the century, everything is magical and wonderful, and famous people were coming to New London, and there was all sorts of casinos. And then the demise of New London, the Pequot Hotel fire, the abandonment of New London, and then you get a desolate play like Long Day's Journey Into Night. And I covered both of those. They were both, you know, first made as plays and then later made into films. Those are the only ones that are actual plays, but written while Eugene O'Neill lived here in Connecticut.
Nice. I would like to go back a little bit. I'm curious on, having looked up your grandfather, I didn't realize that I knew him from Being There, which, love that film. And I'm curious, in the context of this book, how your grandfather plays in terms of, you know, I mean, I know he's mentioned some of these movies. I'm just curious on your relationship with your grandfather and kind of how that plays into you telling the story. And if there's any stories of your grandfather within this, I'd love to hear them if you're comfortable sharing anything.
Well, I think the most personal story that I, you know, that I tell, he pops up three times. Again, I hadn't planned this. But he first pops up strangely in the Ilya Kazan film Boomerang, because he did a movie called Sea of Grass with Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. And it was the last studio film that Kazan made. Kazan wanted to make it on location. They wouldn't let him. He wasn't happy with the results of the film. And after that, that's when he decided to, you know, make Boomerang in 1947 in Stamford, Connecticut. So that's the first time he pops up. The second time he strangely pops up is that Kazan was part of the group theater. And in the 1930s, the group theater was rehearsing in Brookfield, Connecticut. And they were rehearsing plays that later went to Broadway, like Death of a Salesman, like Waiting for Lefty. And one of the people that is involved in the group theater is a Russian-born actor, teacher, director, Richard Boleslavsky. And that blew my mind, because he later is the director of the film my grandfather stars in, Theodora Goes Wild. So that was a direct tie-in to what I was writing about. It was based in truth, because it's Boleslavsky was here in Connecticut. He was part of the group theater. And then now here he is, he's directing a movie. This isn't a random film. The methods that he employed, realism, you know, moment to moment acting, not this kind of, you know, fake Hollywood acting that people were doing. He wanted realism. And my grandfather, you know, had spoken about that, what a great director he was. And so you had a direct tie to the origin of Boleslavsky being in Connecticut, now doing a Connecticut film. And then I end the chapter with telling a story about watching a Nitrate print of Theodora Goes Wild and introducing it at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. And I really talked this film up as being revolutionary, because I said, you know, it's not a screwball comedy in an era of when they were doing screwball comedies. It's an extremely realistic comedy, and their performances are so naturalistic that it really stands out for me as one of my grandfather's, you know, one of my favorite performances of his. And then we showed the movie, and it just people were going crazy. I mean, there was just laughter. And it was just an incredible experience to see this move, see people's reaction to this film all these years later. And that is, you know, a credit to the director, Boleslavsky. And it ties back to, you know, his origins in the group theater. So was a really great full circle moment for me. And, one, you know, a great way to end it. So there are these. So he slips in and out. And then, of course, you know, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House is a, you know, he is such a wonderful film. And it's so much about Connecticut and the fact that he was involved in the film. I mean, this, you know, I had the idea of doing the book about Connecticut, not because my grandfather had done, you know, two major films that were about Connecticut, but he found his way into the narrative in a way that was very organic, you know.
Did you know how were you going to map this out? Were you kind of figuring out as you went along? Like, what was your process in making this? Did you have, you know, I'm just curious. I know part of it was COVID, you were home. I know that was part of it, but if you had mapped all this out, or if certain things you looked up are giving you knowledge to look into other things and making connections. There's so many different connections. I remember looking at the Dark Suburb Redux, and you're just like, there's so many different circles that meet again, and I'm just like, holy crap, that's amazing.
My process was that I had written this. It begins with the Trailers from Hell site that I'm a part of, and we write essays about movies, and I was shocked that nobody had ever written about The Swimmer. And so I wrote an essay about The Swimmer, and I was never entirely satisfied with it. I kept writing it and rewriting it and rewriting it and, you know, turned it in, but it sort of stayed with me, and people really, really liked it. The film has had some resurgence, but I had a personal story within the, you know, the film that I knew Frank Perry, that we'd shared offices. I got a bit part in a movie, you know, working with him, we became friends. He gave me the movie on a VHS, you know, to watch, and it stuck with me. It's just such a, you know, such a strange film. And so it always had kind of stayed with me. I love Burt Lancaster. He's one of my favorite actors. So during the, when COVID began, as a way to, you know, think, well, let me, what project do I want to work on? I wanted to write an extended essay on The Swimmer, suburbia and dark suburbia. And that was sort of how I began. And I started to work on that. And then that's when I started to look up other films that were in, you know, Connecticut. And then as, you know, I didn't want to give. So I wrote The Swimmer. I didn't even start at the beginning. I said, I'm just going to take a bunch of movies that I like Blandings, like Stanley and Iris, and, you know, and start writing about them. When I got through with Stanley and Iris, which I thought was going to take a week, but ended up taking about a month, that's when I started to realize, oh, there's a book in this. Because Stanley and Iris was not only about the fact that they shot it in Waterbury. The director was Martin Ritt, who'd worked with my grandfather, Jane Fonda, when she, the whole resurgence of Hanoi Jane began in Waterbury. It was the folks from Waterbury that tried to stop the filming. I didn't even know about this. Like people, and I started to read more and more about Waterbury. I didn't really realize. I know that they, you know, they called it Brass City. I didn't really understand why they called it Brass City. You see that it was this huge industrial town. You know, all sorts of immigrants came there to work in the brass factories, the button factories. You know, and I just went down a rabbit hole with, like, what Waterbury is mentioned in Death of a Salesman, Arthur Miller. He talks about, you know, Waterbury and that it was a great place to sell things. And so that's when I started to look at the movie as not only that this is about Stanley and Iris, and now I'm writing about all these unheralded workers, all these immigrants. There's a certain type of house, which was called a triple decker, which is like, you know, they turn these, what would have been big, you know, people turn of the century having these kind of life with father, big houses. Now they became triple deckers with three different immigrant families living on each floor of the house. And then how its demise, you know, once the factory started to close down. But at one point, you know, again, they were supplying buttons for all the military uniforms for the film Gone with the Wind. I mean, you know, there was clock factories that there, people, you know, they were known for their, you know, for their clocks. Waterbury has this, where the train station is, this big clock tower. And now when you go, when you pass it, it's just like, what's this ugly brick? You know, what is this place, you know? And that's when I said, wow, this Waterbury is so much more fascinating. And it gave me not only appreciation for the movie, but an appreciation for Waterbury, what Waterbury meant to Connecticut. And then my personal take is, we need to celebrate Waterbury. Like, these people, they're just ghosts. Like, somebody has to write about this. Somebody has to celebrate these workers. And so the film, you know, in the film, they work in a bakery, but they were working at the old, they're working at one of the, you know, old brass factories in the film. And so I thought the movie is a way to celebrate Waterbury and get people not only from Connecticut, but towns wherever, where they have, you know, workers and the working man, and the way we don't think about these people that went to work in a factory. I mean, that, we used to know people that went to work in a factory. Like, maybe, you know, someone who goes to work at Amazon now, but, you know, we all knew people that, you know, had a lunch pail and went to work. And then, and looking at the movie, you say, yeah, people don't work in these large industrial factories anymore. A sadness permeates the film. And I wanted to you know, the book in many ways is this is a kind of a statement, you know, to look at things that we just abandoned and threw away in America, you know.
And I feel like a lot of the things you talk about, the you know, the businesses, the houses, are kind of presented as a character in this book. I'm curious on the reaction you've gotten overall. I know you've been on tour overall with the book, but also Connecticut. I don't know if it's any different in Connecticut than anywhere else. I'm just curious on your interacting with people, like what has this book opened up in terms of you meeting people and talking about all this stuff?
Well, I've been, you know, really thrilled, actually, just that people have really embraced the book in a way that was kind of unexpected. I always wanted to do a book, you know, that would be accessible to people. It's not, you know, an IMDb list of movies that were made in Connecticut. It tells the story, you know, of the state, and it reminds people of the glory of, you know, our industrial past, the people that worked in these towns, that lived in these towns. And then it also goes into detail about, even in a comedy, like a movie called It Happened to Jane, about how when they took away the railway system, the movie is, you know, this, she lives in a small town. It's supposed to be Maine, but it's actually Chester, Connecticut. Doris Day lives in the small town, and she sells lobsters. And the big conglomerate, New Haven train line, bad guy, decides there aren't enough people in the small town, and he's going to take away, you know, the train stop. And now she doesn't have any way to get her lobsters to New York City. Well, as I'm doing my research, what was actually happening?
Yeah,
because these towns were suddenly cut off. These beautiful little mill towns where people could go hop on the train and go to Boston or New York. Suddenly, the only way they could go was on the freeway, you know. And you have dotted in Connecticut these beautiful little towns that just look abandoned. You know, they maybe have one little street, and then you see all these big brick old turn of the century buildings that have been abandoned. Some of them have been turned into, you know, breweries or, you know, what do they call, mixed use housing and stuff, but most of them are abandoned, you know. And you see how even a movie like that, how the trains that were so vital to Connecticut, that by taking away the trains really damaged the economy of Connecticut. We've never really gotten back. And so part of, again, the reason for the book is to say, look at all we have, look at all of our history, look at all of our rich history, look at all these incredible people that came out of Connecticut that changed the landscape of America, whether it was, you know, Thurgood Marshall trying a case in Bridgeport before he became a Supreme Court justice, Homer Cumming, a landmark prosecutor who then was tapped to be attorney general by FDR. I mean, they were, you know, they influenced America. This woman, Gladys Tabor, who I write about, who's kind of the Martha Stewart of her day, who influenced the film, who Christmas in Connecticut is completely based on her. So it's highlighting all these natives and saying, this is our brand. You know, I don't think Connecticut really, they, over the years, they have struggled with what their identity is. What is our identity? Is it Billions? Is it the television show Billions? Is it where rich people live on the, very close to New York? Or is it Mystic Pizza? Is it like the blue collar fishermen? Or is it the workers of Waterbury or Norwich? You know, there's so much interesting things going on here that I love. So I hope people use it as a blueprint to bring back films here and do stories about some of the people, you know, that live here and the biggest, I guess, surprise, it's not a surprise to me. You know, I think my publisher, and I picked a Connecticut publisher because I wanted it to be all Connecticut. You know, I think they assumed that maybe it would only be a book for people in Connecticut. And then I, you know, I said, no, it's a book about movies. It's, you know, and it's for movie lovers like me. And it's also for people that aren't, it's to get them excited about movies, you know, excited about a movie like Everybody Wins, that's sort of a flawed movie, but with Nick Nolte and Deborah Winger and script by Arthur Miller. And, you know, there are these fascinating films and that have been sort of overlooked in a way. And so you put them all in the book, and there are lots of pictures to look at. And it also encourages people, I hope, in their own states to do their own road trips. You know, I really had fun. I mean, wherever I'm working in a movie, I always love to go about and travel and look at the town. But oftentimes we don't travel so much in the state that we're living in, you know, and you can really, it sounds like a cliche, but we overlook it. Like by looking at the history of the state, you can kind of see the problems that one has currently by looking at the past.
It's weird because I travel more doing photography, and I'll go into a town, and you can see where the town had died over the last 6 years, and you can see where now they're like, there's a town not far where they're bringing it up, and you're like,
right,
why don't you just put that money into reviving this town, because you're just making this whole thing start again to then die again. Why do something new if you can? And again, like, our page is all based on, you know, older, I mean, it's based on vintage, but it's also this idea of, I don't know, like, I there's so many things out there that people don't know about that I don't necessarily know if I want to talk about new things, because there's so many things out there that people have, like, and I think, what, again, with this book, like, you talk a lot about, you know, like, feminism and race and class, and there's so much knowledge in there that if people understood, we might not be doing this same dumb circle. We might not be at a point where it's 2023 and we're still talking about, we still haven't figured this out, because people, they're forgetting it. And it's a shame, because I think, with, again, I did the whole dodge of, like, if you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going, it really spells out. I have one more question and then I'll let you go. If you were to take this book and, say, do a film festival around it, celebrating the book, what movies would you show? And then we'll leave it there.
Oh, goodness. I, for me, of course, starting in the, if I'm going with the earlier films, I think you have to show Gentleman's Agreement and Boomerang together. They're both by the same director, Ilya Kazan. They're the two films he made before he made On the Waterfront. And so while On the Waterfront is heralded, it is in the film Boomerang that he gains his style, this kind of neo-realism, experimenting in Stamford, Connecticut. This was based on a real murder that is unsolved to this day. And there was tremendous pressure, you know, to pin the murder on somebody, and they end up pinning it on this soldier. It's all based on a true story. And those kind of dirty, you know, dirty politics are happening in small towns to this day. And injustice, that kind of injustice. And there is a, you know, there's a scene that is brutal. It's 1947, you know, in which they coerce him, basically beat him up until he confesses to this murder. And these kind of things, you know, when you can see a movie like this that's in the past, and we can sometimes movies, you know, they give us something to talk about. I mean, I would love to see people in schools, you know, watching this film and being able to talk about it. All sides are presented in the film. So Boomerang, of course, Gentleman's Agreement, which again is just about, it's about bigotry and just this idea, which we do movies where it's about obvious bigotry, but what I like about Gentleman's Agreement is this kind of hidden bigotry, that where you think you're a nice person, but if somebody tells a joke, like, you're not, you can't stand up and you don't want to shake things up. And so that one's, you know, really important. And of course, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, because this is something we're wrestling with today, this, the American dream. How important is it to have a house with a white picket fence? Is it still important? Is the American dream a sham? I don't, you know,
it's a good question to ask.
Even though
it's a very important question to ask.
I write about it in the book. Although it's a comedy, he's completely in debt with this house. And the message of the movie is just keep spending and spending and spending. And somehow in the end, it'll all work out, because we have this, right? And you're watching the movie going, well.
How well is that working for us these days, you know?
Yeah. So I would have to, you know, include, of course, the swimmer, because that is good or bad. It heralds a little bit of my childhood. You know, I grew up in the 70s, where parents were just completely deconstructing, you know. It was not Mr. Blandings. It was the opposite of Mr. Blandings. We were latchkey kids. We never really saw our parents. They were just, you know, doing their own thing, and it was the complete destruction of, you know, the American dream.
Yeah, we're about 9 years apart, so it was not far from my own experiences.
Yeah, exactly. And then it's hard not to include the Stepford Wives, because again, although it's a flawed movie, I wrote about it from this feminist point of view, that the tag of being a Stepford wife, because the writer wrote it about people from Connecticut, this need to fit in and toe the line and not speak up and be a Stepford wife. I don't exactly know, again, if that's a true label, or if that was a label, you know, written by the screenwriter, William Goldman, who wanted the women to be, you know, playboy bunnies in the film. And it's a very, to me, subversive film. Nobody has looked at it from the woman's point of view.
Well, and you had connected it, you had connected it somewhere in the book, that, or whoever it was, that it is influenced by Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, right, like, it's the same movie, which I never would have thought in 1,000 years that there would be a connection with those two films.
Yes, and here we are all these years later, and we're talking about AI, and the message of the movie is, you know, women would be just much better off if they were robots, if they didn't have little opinions about things, if they just looked up to their husband. And you know, this was presented, I think I wrote about it, you know, they couldn't, when the director, this is my favorite thing that I'm writing about, when they showed this movie to they thought they were making a pro-feminist movie. They thought they were satirizing.
The men thought that, oh, okay.
And the women were horrified. Like, they were like, this is basically destroying everything that we are, you know, everything that we are fighting for. Because, you know, at the end of the movie, Joanna has been turned into, you know, a robot. She doesn't get out. She's turned into a robot. And so I wrote about it from that kind of point of view. There's the
very end. Dark, and it's a very dark ending.
Yeah, because I was wrestling with that idea that the end of the movie, you know, they have silenced her, and that's more chilling than the horror movie, is that. And I draw that line from idyllic Connecticut to Mr. Blandings, where, you know, Myrna Loy is completely involved in the decorating, to now you have with Stepford, you know, a woman who she's basically been given a lobotomy, you know, And that is the perfect, and that is presented as the these women sort of gliding towards the camera, that they are, they're perfect women now. And it's more disturbing that I think, you know, it's camp. When people look at it, you know, in the same way as the 60s sex comedies. Oh, they're not to be taken seriously. They're camp movies, they're horror movies. Like, I don't think they're really horror movies. They're a subversive message in Stepford Wives, that she is silenced at the end. She is turned into, she's been lobotomized, you know?
Let's pick one more and we'll call it a day. What's the bookend? What's the last movie you're shown? What's the bookend? And I don't remember the first one, but what's the bookend of the first one? If maybe that's a simpler question.
I think I would show, you know, I would have to show, I'd end with a feel good movie, which is It Happened to Jane. The entire movie happened because of a complete accident. Richard Quine, the director, was unhappy. You know, it was supposed to be shot in Maine. They couldn't find a location. He lived in New York. One day he said, I'm just going to get in my car, kind of drive up the freeway. And he sees a little town. He sees a sign that says Chester. And it just sounded funny. So he pulls the car off and he goes into this little idyllic, you know, Currier and Ives town, which is called Chester, Connecticut. And calls the studio and says, I found the place where I want to make the movie. And then rents a house in downtown Chester. He was going through a divorce, so he rented a house, and he lived in the house with Ernie Kovacs and Jack Lemmon and Max Showalter, they were all the actors of the movie. Like, so you think like a low budget.
Right.
It was a studio film, but not a big studio film. They didn't live in a hotel. They all lived on location. Doris Day lived in another house. So they were living in this town, and people in the town, like, for instance, they had to, part of the movie is, you know, they needed to have a lobster that moved, you know, a lobster prop. And same thing, couldn't get the right kind of a lobster. So they had a local artisan. Like Hollywood, like, couldn't get it right. They had local people make the right kind of lobster that would move and do all the things they wanted it to do. They needed to build a replica of a train called the Old 97. Local people, everyone in the town of Chester appears in the movie as an local Cub Scouts were doing night scenes. There's a big scene with Doris Day where she sings a song called Be Prepared. And all the kids in the town were, you know, their parents just let them go and be in this movie. And so the whole theme of the movie is how the town rallies around Jane and they defeat, you know, the big bad railroad guy. And the whole making of the movie was about how the whole town got involved to help Richard Quine make this movie. And that, I think, could only happen in Connecticut. And Chester has remained, more than any other town I write about, the same. It's flourished. It's the kind of fantasy town that we think of when we think of Connecticut. It's a walkable, there's little coffee shops and art galleries, and there's a farmer's market, you know, on the weekends, and the people are nice, and they're, it's idyllic. It's the kind of town where your neighbors, you know, the people seem incredibly nice. It's a wonderful town to go visit. And I feel that all the values that are expressed in the film remain in the, you know, in the town.
That's really amazing. Is there anything you're pitching in conjunction with this? Are you still on, this should be out in about, we're going to probably put this out in about 2 weeks in the sooner side. Are you still on doing a book tour? Is there anything you want to, any pitches for the book, where they can get it, where you're any other things you're doing involved with the book that you want to let people know about before we go?
As far as the book tour, I'm doing events here in Connecticut. I don't know if this will maybe not be out yet, but I'll be at the Kate Theater in Old Saybrook November 15th. I'll be at Mark Twain. Yeah, November 30th, I'll be at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. in California. I have a Facebook page, Connecticut in the Movies, and you can see all my, I'll be in Los Angeles. I'm going to go to Palm Springs. I will be in Chicago, November 5th and 5th, planning a trip to Cincinnati, planning a possible trip to Portland. So a lot of the places I've worked in my career, maybe visited my last book tour, I'll be visiting some of those places. But my only, and then after, you know, the, there's another book that I want to work on, but hopefully the book also just sets up, there's a couple things that I'm working on TV movie wise that I think would be perfect fits for filming in Connecticut. So hopefully
congratulations on the making such, I mean, I love it. You know, it's a beautiful book. I love all the, I mean, I'm an archivist in certain ways. I love all the images, all the stuff in here. It really blew my mind. I really thank you for your time, and it was a pleasure to read this. And I'm dyslexic, and I this was a read. I read this from start to finish, which hasn't happened in about 6 years.
Oh, great!
But thank you so much. It was great, Elaine. Really great meeting you. Thank you. You have a great night.
Thank you. You too. So long. Bye.
Hey, thanks for checking out this episode. If you don't follow our Instagram, please do, Vintage Annals Archive. We have a Jewish Vintage Annals Archive page that also has a podcast. Most of them have been on this one. At some point, we'll be doing some episodes that are a little, that might vary and might be only on one. We also have a great one called Pelt, a Minx podcast. Minx is an amazing show. And if you listen to the episode that we're putting out soon with Anna Biller, her first movie Viva was based in the same magazine that influenced Minx. So yeah, Joy, please follow our stuff. Please share. We don't really have any advertising money, and we could use all the help we can getting the word out. Even like Instagram kind of limits us in promoting our own podcast without spending money, which sucks. So whatever you can do to spread the word on the page and on the podcast especially is greatly appreciated. Until next week, thank you. We thought in different ways.